G'day and welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast. My name is Holden Shepherd and today I'm talking to author Steve Hawke about his new book, Out of Time. Steve Hawke grew up in Melbourne, then lived in the Kimberley for many years before settling in the Perth Hills. His first adult novel, The Valley, was published in 2018. Out of Time is his second novel. He's also written for the stage play Jundamara, the libretto for the dramatic cantata Jundamara Sing for the Country, and the children's novel Barefoot Kids. His non-fiction writing includes Nookumbar, Whose Land, Whose Law, the biography Polly Farmer, and A Town is Born, the Fitzroy Crossing story. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
G'day, Holden. Good to be here.
Thank you so much. Now, look, Out of Time is such a powerful, sometimes confronting exploration of aging and of dementia and, you know, what a diagnosis or a feared or impending diagnosis can lead to, both in the life of the sufferer and also the family and friends that are around them. I noticed in your acknowledgements you had a family member who'd suffered with Alzheimer's. Is that what inspired you to write this story? And could you talk a little bit about, you know, where this story came from?
Oh, look, the novel absolutely comes out of my personal experience of witnessing my mother suffer with Alzheimer's and the ravages that it wrought upon her, and thinking about really what that meant. I suppose, you know, what it meant to me if I were to, you know, come down with the same affliction. And it did have that sort of very personal echo of both my mum and my aunt had come down with Alzheimer's. And I found myself thinking about what would happen if I were to show signs of it. And I call the book at one level a sort of a working out in novel form of that conceptual dilemma. So, yeah, that's where the book originated, absolutely.
And it's interesting that, you know, I mean, that must have been really difficult to go through with family members, and I think you've explored that really well through the character of Joe. I think early in the book he talks about, you know, well, I've got it so good, you know, currently, like, you know, his relationship with Anne is really good, and he's terrified that everything's going to slip away. I was curious about how you structured the narrative itself. So it's kind of a series of vignettes and scenes, and I interpreted it as, you know, Joe's life maybe flashing before his eyes before he died. Obviously, that's just a random interpretation, but could you talk a bit about, you know, how you structured that narrative?
Look, these things just sort of unfold, really, rather than being very carefully planned. I mean, you talk about the vignettes, and yes, it is mostly a series of short scenes, you know, some of which are set in the present and in the present tense, and some of which are the various characters remembering things from earlier on. But yeah, it is that sort of vignette style. In its first draft, it was essentially chronological. You know, I mean, it still contained the flashbacks and the memories, but the material set in the current tense was chronological. But I think, you know, the first, apart from, you know, immediate family, the first person to read it for me was Ray Coffey, one of the founding publisher at Freo Press, who's still a good mate of mine. And we agreed after talking about it that basically it was a bit slow to get moving and it needed a bit more bite up front. And it was out of looking at that and thinking about that that there was a decision made to bring some of the material forward. So it's got this, I suppose you'd almost call it a prologue. It's a three-chapter prologue, which sort of sets the scene, and then it moves back and loops forward again to that point before then continuing in a fairly straightforward arc. But these are just the things you do when you're writing. You know, you work out what's going to work best for the story you're telling. It's not really a thing. Well, in my case, at least, that you plot out carefully beforehand. You find what works for the story you're telling.
It unfolds naturally. I actually found it interesting that there was talk of the Mobius loop within the story, and it's kind of, it just reminded me of how the story is kind of structured, because it does have these kind of loops back and forth to, you know, certain points in time that I thought kind of reflected, you know, had Joe's having these own kind of these loops and these thoughts that were going on, you know.
Yeah, the Mobius loop actually came into the story fairly late in the piece. It was just, you know, I was writing a scene between Joe and his young architect mate, and it sort of jumped its way into that conversation just out of nowhere, and then sort of wormed its way further into the story as a bit of a theme.
But I think it's an effective one, so it's wormed well.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was really happy with it when I sort of stumbled across it, in that, you know, there's the weirdness of Alzheimer's and of faulty memories and of, you know, sort of, you know, these loops, as I described them, that Joe has, that you're never quite sure where he's going to come out of them. So, yeah, it was a very effective sort of, image to use, I think.
It was. And I think now that you've mentioned that you kind of brought things forward in the story, I'm thinking about the very first scene where you have, or the first vignette anyway, when you have Joe kind of going, I don't remember where I parked my car. Mm. And he's, that's what causes kind of a bit of a spiraling effect for him. And I guess that's really effective, because if we didn't have that at the start, we would be going, you know, like you have it from the start. So you're kind of hooked going, oh my God, is this going to happen to him? And I was wondering, is it just going to be all in his head and he's worried about, you know, for no reason, or is it actually going to be a problem for him? Mm. And I think the way it unfolded was very effective.
Memory and dementia, but the theme of memory is so central to the book. And so having that incident, you know, of a failure of memory right up front without necessarily explaining the why of it immediately is it sets the scene, if you like.
Yeah, it does, and it really frames what comes after, and certainly what comes after is explored through other characters. So we have the idea of suicide and or assisted suicide. These themes are kind of raised several times in the novel. So you have the context of Joe's Auntie Betty, who, I don't know if I want to say exactly what happens, but there's a situation there. Then you've got the demise of Uncle George, and that's kind of contrasted between the two of those characters and how they their lives end. The whole topic is a constant shadow in the book until the very end, which is explored. Well, you take us all the way. You don't kind of shy away from it. Was this a conversation, or do you think it's a conversation that society, you know, we need to engage with more? I mean, I know it's talked about, but do we need to talk more about it?
Well, it's certainly been talked about at the moment. It's there's assisted suicide legislation now on the books in Victoria, and likely to be on the books in WA, the way things are shaping. Does society need to engage with it more? I'm not sure. I think it's a good thing that these things are being confronted and dealt with, but in this territory, laws can never be enough and can never cover all situations. And certainly both of the sets of laws in Victoria and WA don't address the issue of dementia. They assume and insist that the person making the decision will be in their right mind. And that's sort of the core of what I set out to explore, because I didn't know what the answer was. I mean, the central character, Joe, I have him say something along the lines of, you know, a person with dementia and no memory and no sense of self and no connection to those around him, yeah, what is he but a shell? And that's, I can tell you that is pretty much my own sentiment. Yeah, what the book finishes up being about is exploring that thought to its to as far as it can take it, I suppose.
Yeah, I thought especially right towards the end, where you have, I mean, you have Joe literally say, like, he's like addressing the future coroner, kind of going like, change the bloody law. And I did wonder, I was going to ask, you know, is that the perspective you took after having kind of lived through some of these experiences with family members? Did you come away from this thinking we need to change this law?
Yes, but not in a campaigning sense. I mean, I'm no Andrew Denton. I admire the man greatly for what he's doing, but you know, it's not something I'm going to become a campaigner for. I'm a person who sees shades of grey and difficulties and complications in just about everything I look at. So I don't think I'd make a terribly good, yeah, sort of deliberator on matters like that.
Fair enough. And certainly there's space for the campaign, and there's space for just exploring it in a really nuanced way in literature, which is what I think Out of Time does.
Yeah, well, that's my territory rather than the legislative territory.
Sounds good. I'm all on board with that myself. I feel the same way. So let's talk about kind of an aspect of this, because in the story, Joe and Anne's daughter, Claire, becomes an evangelical Christian when she meets Jeffrey, and that kind of, you know, Jo's got this real resistance to, like, you know, oh, every 5 minutes it's the church, or, you know, like, she's talking about this every 5 seconds. Do you think fundamentalist, you know, kind of religious convictions end up framing the discourse around euthanasia?
Well, they certainly like sticking their bibs in.
Yeah, I've noticed.
Look, you know, if people want to be evangelical Christians, that's their business. But as far as I'm concerned, they have no right to try and impose their morals on everyone else in the society. So I'm not a person who has a lot of time for that view of the world. So, but, you know, they're around and they make a lot of noise.
Yeah.
And it becomes very much a dilemma for Claire in this book. I mean, there's not only a relationship with her fellow, which becomes difficult, but the clash between her religious beliefs and what her father's going through. And I think what comes out in the story is that it's her love for and connection to her father that is the most important thing to her.
Absolutely. And I think the love is really well explored as well with both Jo and Claire and Jo and Anne. And I think I'll ask about that in a little while. But I was curious about the telling of this story in terms of form, because you mentioned you thought it might be a stage play, and that's a form you've worked in previously. I was curious what made you, or how do you know what's going to work? Like, how do you come to a project and go, this one's not a play, it's a novel?
I'm not being facetious when I say trial and error. I did actually write it as a play, but couldn't find a producer for it. And,
right.
And look, that's been the case with other things I've done. I mean, Jundamara, which is, you know, being performed as a stage play and as a musical cantata, was originally conceived as a film script. Barefoot Kids, my kids' novel, was originally conceived as a TV series. So, it's can be as simple as a matter of practicality. I mean, if there's a story inside you bursting to get out, finding a form that not only works creatively, but also the market will buy.
I think, yeah, you're right. There's that thing of, you know, one, it's got to work for your expression, and two, is the market there in that form, or do you have to shift to, as you say, is it not a TV show but a novel?
Yeah, and I'm just, I think this book, Out of Time, does work well as a novel, and I think it's probably a much better novel than it ever would have been as a stage play. So, yeah.
I agree. Yeah, it's a fantastic
novel. So, you know, perhaps I'm lucky that the stage play never worked and never got picked up. But yeah, so it's not as if you make the right choice the first time round all the time. You just have to keep plugging away. And, you know, I mean, all I could say, I suppose, is thank God I did make that choice and had a crack at it as a novel, and it's not just sitting in a bottom drawer as an unproduced play.
I agree. I think you've made the most of it, and it works spectacularly well as a novel. And I would say, you've now got the added bonus that, you know, someone might go, a good novel, we're going to pick it up and adapt it as a stage play.
Well, you never know. I never say never.
Sounds like a good motto to me. Now, I've got a bit of a random question, and sure. I don't know if it'll be something you want to talk about or not, but it was just something I noticed, and that's around the role of architecture in the novel. Because I always think architecture is interesting about being something that is like a legacy. So, you know, you build something, it stays there after you're dead, and something survives after you're gone. And with so much of this book being about, you know, human life being impermanent and memory being fragile and temporary, was there any kind of link between, you know, Jo and his architectural kind of ambitions and what's happening with his memory?
Look, not really is the short answer to that question. I mean, I think I say in an author's note at the start of the book that the writer will take no responsibility for any buildings that fall down. I mean, I'm not an architecture nerd. It's not my secret love or anything. It just, when I was developing the story, it seemed like an appropriate profession for the sort of character that I had in mind for Jo. And I think why it interested me and it worked as a vehicle for him is that it's it's a profession that is a combination of art and science. You know, it requires creativity, but it also requires really strong engineering skills. And and there often is a tension in the profession between those. And I sort of play with that a bit. I think there's a quote in there somewhere where he quotes his beloved prof, the professor who taught him, you know, who you know, the book opens, you know, at the time of the prof's death. And what was it the prof says? Something along the lines of, the mathematician must trail in the wake of the artist. The engineer should be the slave to the muse. And that's sort of how Joe views architecture, although some of his contemporaries don't. But look, I'm not an architecture nut. It was just something that worked for the story to and for Joe's characters to have that as his profession.
Yeah, I think it works really well. I think it kind of ties in beautifully with the ideas surrounding, you know, Joe's musings on life. And I think something I found as well, you know, there's pretty dark subject matter. I mean, we see, you know, it's not that it's necessarily graphic all the time, but we're dealing with very complex and dark thoughts. But there was a lot of humour. I thought there was a lot of humour in Joe's thoughts and in the dialogue, in his relationship with Eric, for example. There was fun and there was humour. What role did humour play for you in writing this story?
It's incredibly important, just as it is in real life. I mean, you know, if you can't have a laugh, you might as well give up, you know. and it's the dynamic of this particular family. It's how Joe and Anne, you know, sort of work their way through difficult situations at times, is to make silly jokes or find some humour in it. And Claire's grown up with that and has the same sort of, you know, sort of jesting, bantering way of dealing with things. And it's just part of life, I reckon. At least I hope it is for most people. You know, laughter is hugely important, and dark humour is often the best humour, isn't it?
I was going to say, I think so. I mean, I've gone through things in life, and you, I agree with you. I think you find the way forward. You either laugh or you cry. You know, like, you know, what are you going to do? You choose the option where you can laugh through it. And I think Joe does that really well. I think Anne is really interesting. I think she sounds like a real person to me. I mean, Joe and Anne both do. They sound like real people. You know, like, I feel like I've heard these voices, and it felt very authentic to me. I want to talk about the kind of responses to Joe's condition, because Anne is that kind of champion, I think. I mean, she has her moments, but she was very supportive and really strong, I thought, while Joe's best mate is having this massive struggle and he just can't deal with it. And he really just steps away and Joe feels really abandoned. Was it important to you to kind of depict that, you know, there's people have different contrasting reactions to this kind of diagnosis? And what, you know, what can people do to best manage the process, or is it just up to the individual?
Oh, look, it's very much an individual thing. I think you just asked, was it important to depict these reactions? And actually, the answer to that is no, because what is important is, as you work your way into the story and as you're writing it, is to make the reactions and the actions and behaviours true to the characters. That's what is important. And that is what felt true for each of them. And look, that is reality. There are people who find it incredibly difficult to spend time with people who are in the depths of dementia, because it can be pretty difficult to handle and difficult to witness. And Eric is sort of a manifestation of that sort of character. But it's not about, at least for me, you know, sort of having a predetermined set of reactions or characteristics that you want to portray. It's a matter of, you know, there's four main characters in this book, and once the characters become sort of fixed in your head and you know who you're writing with and who you're writing about, what you have to do is make their behaviour true to those characters.
Yes, absolutely. So it has to fit with whoever you're dealing with at the time. Yeah. But I really found, personally, I was reading it and going, oh, how could Eric let him down like that? Like, I really wanted him to come through, you know, after that first message he sends. And he's kind of like, oh, there's this little message saying, oh, devastated, mate. And he's like, oh, but there'll be more. And I was like, oh, yeah, what'll happen next? And then there was just nothing.
Yeah, life always doesn't go according to plan.
No, it really doesn't. And I think this book is such an example of, that family kind of saga where things do take twists and turns, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. And I think it's a really a great exploration of that. We have time now for a short reading, if that's okay.
I'm happy to do that. Yeah.
Excellent. So which segment were you planning to read from?
Look, I've plucked the second chapter, which is titled Burrup Birds. So being the second chapter, it's obviously very early in the book. It's part of that prologue, if you like, that I was talking about. And it's really just because I like it as a bit of writing and a bit of description. I mean, there's not enough time to really set the scene of the novel in something like this, so I'll just give you Burrup Birds. Anne has just left Joe behind in Perth and flown up to Karratha, where daughter Claire is expecting any day. So here we go.
Over to you.
The sea eagle glides out of sight beyond the ridge line. Anne lowers her binoculars, notes the date and details in her field book, then relaxes against the boulder at her back to absorb the vista. Just down to her left, a single bright red desert pea catches her eye. There are random clumps of pale, wiry spinifex amongst the jumble of angular, deep brown rocks tumbling down to a narrow white beach. A thin fringe of mangroves curves out towards a small headland. The sea is a vibrant azure, glinting with sun sparkles dotted with rocky islets. The mammoth low-slung iron ore tankers out beyond the island seem toy-like at this distance. She can feel herself opening up to this country. It is not the inland Pilbara of her youth, the parched grandeur of the Ophthalmia Range, the deep gorges and hidden pools of the Hammersleys. But even amidst the gritty industry of the ore wrought from the earth, there is an ancient power in the land, with the mysterious engravings of the Burrup bearing eternal witness. The bowler she has chosen as her backrest is the canvas for her favourite, a pair of grouse-like birds in plump profile and a clutch of eggs. She knows it's frowned upon, but she cannot resist the urge to reach up and briefly feel a connection to the pocked outline of this creature from a time beyond memory. Joe will be doing his presentation about now, she thinks. She mentally crosses her fingers for him, then pushes the unbidden thought away. It feels out of place here, out of sync with the yearning for wildness this wide Pilbara sky engenders in her soul. These few hours with her binoculars and field book, the bounty of the Burrup, feel like a blissful bonus. But even at Clare's in the Karratha suburbs that are superficially hardly distinguishable from those of Perth, she feels as if there is more room for her spirit to flourish than humdrum life in Perth allows. She is honest enough to sprinkle a grain or two of salt on such thoughts, to realise that at the moment she is predisposed to this expansive frame of mind. Expectant Granny Hood can do that to you. She has been up here for almost a week, counting down with Claire, awaiting the arrival of her first grandchild. Almost as nervous, almost as excited as Claire, and revelling in the sweetness of this mother-daughter time at such a juncture in their lives. In a perfect world, Joe would be here too. He has yearned for this grandchild as much as she has, but sadly, there are reasons for his absence beyond his work commitments. A top-knot pigeon whirs in and alights by the desert pea. She is instantly alert, absorbed, delighting in its perky manner as it inspects the ground for seeds. A peck, a crick of its neck, an eye in her direction that feels almost like a greeting, then gone in a blur of wings. She would like to linger longer, but she is on cooking duties. Getting to her feet, she drinks in the view one last time, then turns to the pair of graven birds. She places her hand flat on the smooth rock face beside them, shaded now, but still warm from the sun. She draws in that warmth and energy. Her thought had been to ask, to summon, if she could, a secret blessing for the child about to be born in this land of ancient beings. She makes her plea. And with that act of outreach, of speaking to the land, she feels a lurch, a shift within that she does not yet understand.
That was Steve Hawk reading from his new novel, Out of Time. And Steve, what a really great foreboding moment to finish on. Anne doesn't know what's about to hit her, or to hit all of them, I guess. Thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. It's been such a pleasure to chat.
No, you're very welcome. It's always nice to talk books.
So, Steve, your book is already available. Is that right?
Yeah, it was released at the start of August. So it's out there. Go and grab it, folks.
Fantastic. And look, it is a compelling, powerful read, full of really great Aussie voices. And I think it's a very, very timely book to release, especially around the legislation that's happening now. So, Steve, thank you very much for such an important book.
Thank you, Holden.
Cheers.